when we think about globalization, that it isn't only about the economics of globalization, which is at the root of it, but what we're really talking about, when we're talking about the global war on terror, we're talking about the globalization of war. We're talking about a powerful country, in this case the United States, essentially taking the world to war, whether or not the world thinks that that's the best approach to instances of terror, instances of violence, or whatever else it may be. The question of not whether you respond, yeah, when there's violent attacks, you respond, but how you respond, with what do you respond, against whom do you respond, in collaboration with whom do you respond, all of those questions somehow get put aside. And the politics of fear takes over, and the use of power takes over, so that the country with, in this case, the biggest economy, the most powerful army, the most powerful nuclear arsenal, and the only country that can function as an old-fashioned kind of superpower, there are lots of new superpowers, but the only old-fashioned superpower who can bring unchallengeable economic and military and political and diplomatic pressure to bear on pretty much any country in the world, gets to decide how are we writ large, we the whole world, how are we going to respond to these acts of terror? So that's kind of what we are looking at. And we can trace this to the attacks of September 11th of 2001. At that time, the immediate response of people in the United States was one of fear. It had been before anyone alive at that time that there had ever been an act of war committed in the United States. We had gotten very used to the idea that being in between two big oceans and two very friendly and very dependent countries somehow made us safe, that nobody could ever attack the United States. That you sort of grew up believing that. And so the attacks of September 11th were absolutely frightening for people in this country. Unlike most people around the world who had faced terrorist attacks, wars, attacks by the US, attacks by others opposing the US, it was an old story. In this country, it wasn't. And when that happened, we were given by the administration of George Bush one choice. You either go to war or you let him get away with it. That was the option. That was the only option. And since nobody wanted to let him get away with it for perfectly reasonable reasons, the choice was war. And 88% of people across this country supported going to war. Nobody asked, wait a minute, are there other options? Are there other ways of responding to this horrific crime? That wasn't allowed. Calling it a crime was somehow defending it. Saying we have to try and figure out why, not so much why would people do this, because people can be sociopaths and do something and you could never give a rational reason to it, but why was it that people around the world helped and governments supported and other people thought maybe it wasn't such a bad idea? So the choice that we got was not that. The choice was not, could we look at alternative ways of dealing with this? Could we look at this as a huge crime rather than an act of war? And if it's a crime, how do you deal with crime? How do you deal with a global crime? How do you deal with international law and make it work? No, those were not options that were on the table. War was on the table. And what we then had were wars first in Afghanistan and soon in Iraq. And those wars were devastating. I'm not going to go through the whole history of those wars, but you all know enough history to know how devastating they were for the peoples of Afghanistan and Iraq and the region. But they also failed, as we now see. They failed to stop terrorism. They failed to prevent future acts of attacks, whether in the US or anywhere else. And why is that? It's because you can't bomb extremism. You can drop a bomb on some extremists. If you're lucky, you might even hit them. But you probably are also going to hit their families. You're definitely going to destroy property around them. You're definitely going to destroy people in their family, their clan, their tribe, their religion, their village, their country. And those people are going to be pretty damn pissed off about it. So you're going to create enemies every time you drop bombs. And you're not going to end terrorism by doing it. the question of against whom do you attack has very little to do with what are they alleged to have done, and rather has everything to do with where are they, what country, are these good Muslims or bad Muslims, is this a good government or a bad government? These are the kinds of questions that actually determine when, against whom, using what weapons, where, for how long, the U.S. goes to war. So that's the first GWAT. This was always one of my favorite acronyms. You know, acronyms are usually, well, whatever they are. This one sounds like what it is, the GWAT, the Global War on Terror, was the acronym that the Bush administration created. And I always thought this was like the best acronym because it has that terrible sound to it. GWAT sounds evil, which is, in my view, quite appropriate. Then we get a president who came into office campaigning on the idea that the Iraq War was a dumb war and saying, I don't believe in dumb wars. He said, I'm not a pacifist, but I don't believe in dumb wars. That seemed pretty good to me and to a lot of people. The Afghanistan war is a good war, we're going to escalate. The Iraq war is a bad war, it's a stupid war, we're going to end it. But it turned out that the wars got worse. Troops were withdrawn from Iraq, but it had left behind such devastation in Iraq that a civil war that had already grown up alongside the anti-occupation war in Iraq exploded, became far worse. Many more civilians were being killed. The withdrawal of the U.S. troops didn't create that, but it didn't prevent it either. And for civilians, for ordinary people trying to live a life in a country that had been absolutely devastated by the first war against Iraq, before that, by the Iran-Iraq War, then by the first U.S. war against Iraq in 1991, then by 12 years of crippling sanctions that absolutely shredded the social fabric of the country, once a very developed, middle-class, advanced country in terms of medicine, in terms of education, and ironically, a country with one of the narrowest gap between wealth and poverty of any country in the Middle East. With all of the problems of political repression that were so real under Saddam Hussein, economic and social rights of most people were well respected. So it was lost. All of that was lost over the 12 years of sanctions. And then shock and awe, destruction of the infrastructure once again, and years, more than almost a decade, of U.S. war and occupation. So the situation for people in Iraq has been far worse. And again, you didn't have the end of terrorism, the end of a resistance movement, it morphed into a far broader resistance movement. One of the many organizations that sprung up in 2004 to challenge the U.S. occupation of their country was called the Al-Qaeda in Iraq. They took the name. They weren't particularly connected to Al-Qaeda. They just took the name. Al-Qaeda in Iraq was later called Al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia, later changed its name to become the Islamic State in Iraq, has now morphed into, wait for it, ISIS. ISIS emerged to challenge the U.S. war and occupation in Iraq. If there had been no U.S. occupation of Iraq, there would have been no ISIS. Doesn't mean there wouldn't have been something else, maybe, maybe not, but this was a direct result of the U.S. occupation. So without that, we would not have faced what we face today. So what does that mean for the region? We have this reality where using war against terrorism, we've seen, doesn't work. It empowers terrorists. It spreads terrorism. It makes it more popular. It breeds anger. It's an astonishing thing that that can be so obvious to so many in this country and around the world and be so consistently ignored by those in power to choose a different path, to choose a different alternative. So we now have the GWAT 2.0, Global War on Terror on steroids, because President Obama turns out to not have been such an anti-war president as many people thought. He not only escalated the war in Afghanistan, he vastly expanded the drone war to countries far beyond the so-called war zones of Iraq and Afghanistan. You now have a full-scale drone war in Pakistan, in Yemen, in Somalia. All of this without the permission of the countries involved. Maybe secretly, some of them say it's go ahead, maybe not. But in the real world, that's not how international law gets either violated or abided by. You know, these are illegal wars that are violating international law on a daily basis. We have a new position. The Obama administration said the first thing we want to do is close down Guantanamo because we think it's bad for the U.S. Not because it's bad for the people being tortured there, but because it's bad for the U.S. because it gives us a bad name. It gives us a black eye. Well, that was also all true. And when Congress made it hard, instead of the Obama administration saying, you know what, we're going to figure out other things we can do. If we can't bring them to trial here, we'll send them to other countries and be done with it. We'll send them home, including the dozens and dozens of al-Qaeda alleged prisoners who turned out to have nothing to do with al-Qaeda, who turned out to have been in the wrong place at the wrong time, spent years in Guantanamo, many of them being tortured, not all of them, but many of them, being interrogated, not allowed to see their families for years on end. One of them, only 15 when he was arrested and brought to Guantanamo, was finally released when he was 22, spent his teenage years as a prisoner in Guantanamo Bay. So we now have a situation where, because it's hard to figure out how to shut down Gitmo, instead the U.S. is saying, well, we're going to commit not to bring any more prisoners there. So what does that mean? Instead of not taking any prisoners, the U.S. now kills prisoners instead of bringing them to prison. Every morning, every Tuesday morning, there's a kill meeting at the White House. They even call it that, where every morning President Obama sits with his top assistants and goes through the list. They call it the kill and capture list of individuals in Iraq, in Syria, in Yemen, in Afghanistan, wherever they might be, who are now eligible to be killed or captured by U.S. military, U.S. police, by anybody from the U.S. who wants to. And what does that mean? It means the guys who went after bin Laden could have arrested him, could have put him on trial somewhere. What kind of a model would that have been for the world? To say to the world, the worst alleged terrorist in the history of humanity, and we're going to put him on trial because that's what we do in this country. No, that was not even considered. He was to be killed. This was not a kill or capture operation. This was an assassination operation, just as the other assassinations that the U.S. has done in Yemen and elsewhere, including of American citizens, saying it's legal because we got a memo that we asked for from our own Justice Department, says it's legal, and therefore it's legal. Talk about a tautology. You know, it's legal because our side says it's legal, and our side says it's legal because we asked them to figure out an argument for why it would be legal. And therefore, you can't challenge it. This is what we're now facing. So I want to just talk for another minute before we open up. But I think that we do have to look both at what's similar about the Global War on Terror 1 and 2 and what the differences are. One big difference is that the Obama administration is not filled with warmongers as the Bush administration was. It's not made up of people who have either a financial interest in going to war because they, for example, Dick Cheney, just for example, who was had major interests in Halliburton oil services industry, which made billions, many billions, not millions, billions of dollars in contracts in post-war Iraq. He was the vice president, right? You know, we don't quite have that now. We don't have the same intersection of people who have an interest in oil. Condoleezza Rice, you know, was such an important member of the board of Chevron Oil that they named a tanker after her. And then she went to war for oil when she was the national security advisor. So this is what we were dealing with in the Bush administration. It's not quite like that now. But these are still illegal wars. It means that public pressure becomes even more important because it can mean more. We're not competing with the board of directors of Exxon being in the White House. So we have an even greater obligation as citizens in this country and as residents in this country to make clear that we believe there are alternatives. That we do not accept the notion that the only choice is you either go to war or you're letting them get away with it. That we think there are issues of diplomacy, that we don't buy the idea that you can't talk about diplomacy because ISIS is too vicious. It's precisely when you're dealing with vicious forces, whether it be the U.S. military that is killing civilians or whether it be a small group of thugs that are slaughtering people on a retail basis, up close and personal and ugly, like ISIS is doing. You have to have talk. Doesn't mean that your first talks are going to be with ISIS. They're not up for it, neither are we. But you start talking to the people who are arming them. You start talking to the governments that are paying money to them. You start talking to the governments who share a border and allow people to cross their border to join them. That's where you start your negotiations. You start with diplomacy. You start with massively increasing the amount of humanitarian aid to everybody facing the consequences of these wars, whether they live in government-controlled areas of Syria where we don't like the government, or whether they live under the control of either side of the so-called opposition, the good guy opposition, the so-called moderates, who we like, except they're really not in control of anything anymore, or the bad guy opposition, the Islamists who are extremists, and we don't like them. But wherever people live, they are people who have the right to humanitarian protection. So there are a host of things that should be done that are not nothing and are not war. Because the choice of war or nothing is never the choice. And finally, the question of revenge. You know, when the U.S. went to war against Afghanistan after 9/11, it was clearly about revenge. It wasn't the right target. None of the 19 hijackers were Afghans. Most of them were from Saudi Arabia. Three were from Egypt. They didn't live in Afghanistan. They lived in Germany, in Hamburg. They didn't go to school in Afghanistan. They went to school in Florida. They didn't do their flight training in Afghanistan. They did their flight training in Minnesota. So why were we going to war for vengeance against Afghanistan? Because the guy who had inspired them was living in Afghanistan. Oh, well, that makes a lot of sense. That does a lot of good, to go to war for vengeance, war for revenge. But that's what that was. It was not about self-defense. It would have been self-defense, horrific, but self-defense nonetheless, if the U.S. had managed to send a plane up to bring down the second plane before it hit the World Trade Center. That's self-defense. Self-defense is not 3 weeks later going to war against a whole country on the other side of the world. And what we're hearing now is a new set of versions of what does revenge look like. So we have the government of Jordan, who had been quite reluctant to fully go to war, after their pilot, their bomber pilot, was killed brutally. They're ready to go to war now for revenge. The king said, this is for vengeance. This is for our pilot. The Egyptian government already went back to war in Libya in revenge for the killing of 20 Egyptian Copts in Libya. The prime minister of Japan said, I don't care if we do have a constitution that prohibits us from going to war, we now need to go to war for revenge for the killing of our two journalists. So the Global War on Terror 2.0 has given every world leader, legitimate and otherwise, the credibility to say, we have the right to go to war for revenge, because the U.S. set the stage for that by doing it after 9/11. So that's what we're now dealing with. We're dealing with wars being fought for vengeance. And foreign policy based on vengeance was never going to lead to a good foreign policy.